America Looks Abroad. This is the 38th in a series of broadcasts presented by the staff members of the Foreign Policy Association. Today's subject is Germany Strikes at Britain. The speaker is Mrs. Vera Michelis-Dean, Director of the Research Department of the Foreign Policy Association. Mrs. Dean.
Good afternoon. During the past week, Germany has been massing boats, troops, and guns at French ports for what may prove its supreme effort to invade the British Isles. At the same time, German and Italian spokesmen warned their people that war against Britain could not take the form of a lightning conquest like that of France, and that the Germans must be prepared for a hard and possibly a long struggle. These warnings may be intended to dispel illusions of a quick victory among the German and Italian people, but they may also be intended, as Mr. Churchill pointed out yesterday, to take the British off their guard and thus weaken their expected resistance to another blitzkrieg. The Germans apparently hope that by steady bombing of British ports, ships, and industrial centers, they may yet disrupt the country's economic life, cut off Britain's imports from overseas, and bring Britain to its knees without the risk of actual invasion. The Germans are trying to use against Britain the weapon Britain found so effective against Germany in the First World War, the weapon of blockade. Britain is already cut off from imports of foodstuffs and raw materials it used to obtain from the European continent. If its ports are destroyed or seriously damaged, the Germans believe that the British will eventually also find it impossible to import food and raw materials from overseas countries, including the United States. But Britain, too, is still using the weapon of blockade, this time not only against Germany, but against the entire European continent, now under German rule. Before the collapse of France, Germany had no direct access to the Atlantic Ocean. But the moment France capitulated, Germany obtained not only control of French ports on the Atlantic Ocean, but also access to Spain and Portugal, which are still officially neutral. As long as Spain and Portugal remain neutral, they can purchase goods from overseas countries, including the United States, and if they wish, ship these goods to Germany. This is exactly what Britain thought Spain and Portugal were doing. To prevent overseas goods, especially oil, from reaching Germany through Spain and Portugal, Britain has now extended its blockade to cover these two countries, as well as France, which for the time being is regarded by the British as enemy-occupied territory. So while Britain is now unable to obtain any products from the continent in turn can obtain nothing from the Western Hemisphere or Asia without the permission of the British. Britain's blockade of the continent has been reinforced by the action of the American government. On July 25, the United States prohibited the export of oil and scrap metal without a specific license, and prevented cargoes of these materials from clearing for Spain and Japan. On July 31, it went further and ordered an embargo on exports of aviation gasoline to all countries outside the Western Hemisphere, except such quantities as may be needed for the operation of American-owned airplanes operating in foreign services. These restrictions can, of course, be explained by considerations of our own national defense. The United States government regards the international situation with the utmost seriousness. Last Thursday, Secretary of War Stimson, in a statement to the House Military Affairs Committee, said we must take into consideration the possibility that in another 30 days, Great Britain herself may be conquered and her shipyards passed under German control. The government is therefore taking what may appear entirely natural precautions to preserve our stocks of essential war materials and to prevent them from passing into the hands of countries which might become our enemies. At the same time, there is no doubt that the embargo on oil will prove a blow to Spain, where there is a serious shortage of gasoline. It will also prove a blow to Japan, which has been drawing the bulk of its war materials from the United States. An embargo on American war materials may well be regarded by Japan, Germany, and Italy as a hostile measure, even if it technically falls short of war, especially when you consider that the United States is ready to supply Britain with all the airplanes and other war equipment our factories are capable of producing. From the point of view of the United States, however, it would be illogical to rally the country behind a program of defense while permitting the export of war materials that may be subsequently used against us. One argument advanced in the past against an embargo on exports of American oil and scrap metal, notably in the case of Japan, has been that an embargo on oil would merely encourage Japanese invasion of the Dutch East Indies, which are rich, as you know, in oil, rubber, and tin. But the Japanese press has recently indicated that Tokyo was in any case considering the possibility of seizing the Dutch East Indies, while France is prostrate and Britain is engaged in a life and death struggle with Germany. And it isn't by any means certain that compliance with Japanese demands would necessarily improve this country's relations with Tokyo. Britain had just yielded to Japan's demand for closing of the Burma Road, only to discover that the Japanese apparently thought this was a sign of weakness and proceeded to arrest British citizens in Japan on charges of spying. With the adoption of these various measures and countermeasures of economic warfare, the conflicts in Europe and Asia are assuming more than ever the form of an endurance test. Germany and Italy, now excluded from the markets of the Western Hemisphere and Asia, are concentrating their efforts on the development of war materials available in Europe. Germany already has access to the iron ore of Sweden, Spain, and France. In the Balkans, where France and Britain have lost all influence for the time being, Germany is rapidly obtaining control of industrial enterprises formerly owned by French, British, Dutch, and Czech capital. Among these are iron mines in Romania and copper mines in Yugoslavia. But the most important of these enterprises are the Romanian oil wells. The Romanian government has confiscated the British-controlled oil firm Astra Romana. It has expelled French and British oil technicians on the ground they had been plotting to damage the wells. It has seized British oil barges on the Danube. Until now, Anglo-French concerns in Romania had refused to let any of their oil go to the Nazis. Now, if transportation difficulties can be solved, Germany will probably be able to obtain the bulk of Romania's oil exports, which last year amounted to 4 million tons. You can see under these circumstances how important it is for Germany that Romania should remain at peace. That is why the Nazis have done everything in their power to prevent the spread of war to the Balkans. Last winter it had seemed that the French and British might attempt to use the Balkans as a base for operations against Germany. With the collapse of France, this possibility was eliminated. But then Romania's neighbors, Russia, Bulgaria, and Hungary, began to demand part of its territory, and their demands threatened to create a conflict. As you know, Russia did occupy Bessarabia, a province that had formed a part of the Russian Empire until 1918, when it was taken over by the Romanians. Germany did not openly interfere with Russian occupation of Romanian territory, which incidentally brings the Russians within a short distance of the Romanian oil wells. But Hitler did take action when Hungary and Bulgaria, in turn, demanded their share of the Romanian spoils. Now, you'll remember that Hungary and Bulgaria had been associated with Germany in the First World War. They had long been friendly with Germany and Italy, in contrast to Romania, which had been friendly with France and Britain. The Hungarians and Bulgarians had hoped that with the aid of Hitler and especially of Mussolini, they would recover the territories they had lost to Romania. But actually, when the Hungarian and Bulgarian representatives visited Hitler in Salzburg, they were apparently advised to go slow about pressing their claims against Romania and to wait for the final peace settlement, which Hitler expects to make after he has conquered Britain. Hitler told Romania to begin negotiations with Hungary and Bulgaria, and it is possible that some minor concessions may be worked out. But Romania appears unwilling to do more than cede a small strip of territory to Hungary and arrange for exchanges of populations with both Hungary and Bulgaria. Meanwhile, Hungary and Bulgaria appear to be disappointed by the meager results they obtained from Germany. In Bulgaria, the king is pro-Italian. Many of the officials are pro-German. But the population is sympathetic to Russia. The same thing is true of Yugoslavia, which so far has not figured in the negotiations for Balkan reconstruction on the German pattern. It is quite possible that Russia may take advantage of pro-Russian sentiment in Yugoslavia and Bulgaria to try and check German influence in these countries. Russia has been quietly but rapidly consolidating its position, both in the Balkans and in the Baltic region. In elections held under Soviet military control, Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania voted to join the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. The ceremony celebrating this union took place last week in Moscow. It is also reported that Moscow is making additional demands on Finland, and it would not be at all surprising if Russia should occupy the rest of Finland. The Soviet government continues to remain non-committal with regard to the conflict in the West, but there seems little doubt that its main objective is to strengthen its own defenses in such a way that should a victorious Germany eventually turn against Russia, it would find increased resistance there. The Russians, however, believe that Germany will have its hands full reorganizing Europe and will then turn its attention not against Russia, but against the United States. Therefore, Russia has no desire to antagonize Germany. On the contrary, Mr. Molotov, Soviet Premier and Foreign Minister, indicated in his speech last Thursday that the Soviet government feels more hostile toward Britain and the United States than toward Germany. The reason for this is fairly clear. Britain and the United States have criticized Soviet invasion of Finland, and recently Mr. Sumner Wells, our Undersecretary of State, denounced Soviet occupation of Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania in very strong terms. Mr. Molotov made light of these criticisms and replied that the United States itself has imperialistic designs on the Western Hemisphere. He also predicted that the wars in Europe and Asia would spread into a world conflict in which the United States would be aiding Britain against Germany. While the entire world waits in suspense for the outcome of the Battle of Britain, the United States appears to have returned to the state of apathy out of which it had been briefly shaken by the collapse of France. The election campaign occupies the center of the stage, and the attitude of the American people toward foreign affairs remains confused in the extreme. If it were possible to define our foreign policy at this moment, it might be summed up as a series of contradictions. We are building up our own defenses, but we are not certain whether we should wait until our territory has been invaded before using our armaments, or use them to bar German and Japanese influence from the Western Hemisphere. We do not want to become involved in wars outside this hemisphere, but at the same time, we keep on denouncing Germany, Italy, Russia, and Japan in a way which might ultimately involve us in a conflict with one or all of these countries. We do not like the new order in Europe and Asia, but at the same time, we do not want either to come to terms with this new order or to destroy it. We seem to be sorry for the British and recognize that defeat of Britain would greatly increase our own problems. But at the same time, we don't want to help the British beyond permitting them to buy here such war equipment as they can obtain for cash. What we really want is to have our cake and eat it too. That is not possible in a period of revolutionary crisis like the one in which we are living today. Unpleasant as it may seem, we shall have to make up our minds as to what we want to do in world affairs and then do it if we are to escape the danger that our destiny will be settled for us by outside powers.
You have been listening to Mrs. Vera Michelis Dean, Director of the Research Department of the Foreign Policy Association. If you would like a free copy of this talk, send your request to the Foreign Policy Association at number 8 West 40th Street, New York City. The Foreign Policy Association is a nonpartisan organization open to all who are interested in American foreign policy. It offers accurate information on current world events. And in the world of today, foreign affairs are your affairs. We invite you to tune in next Sunday to hear another speaker in the series America Looks Abroad. If you would like that address again, it's the Foreign Policy Association, number 8, West 40th Street, New York City. This is the National Broadcasting Company.